But Angleton was trained in the New Criticism at Yale by Maynard Mack and others, chiefly Norman Holmes Pearson, who's a founder of American Studies. He would briefly study law at Harvard, but did not graduate.
Did that guy, and Maynard Mack, was that his second time coming to Yale? Would it be the return of the Mack?
Return of the Mack.
He says Return of the Mac way too much. In Return of the Mac.
Way too many times. Huh?
Return of the Mac.
Welcome back to the Trilateral Troika. This is Steve along with the other Steve.
I hate these oh fucking DIA nurses, whatever they are. Cunts.
And Ryan.
I think crack one open for Robert Redford, and I think it was those DEI nurses that got him killed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Kill one of the hunks. One of our last hunks.
He's like 85. Oh, they're like, I don't think you could get it up anymore, Mr. Redford. And he's like, you don't think so? And just that, the act of, you know, becoming tumescent, that ended him.
Listen, for your medical minute here, I'm just going to tell you, check your blood pressure. Make sure your blood pressure stays in control. And guys, specifically speaking to you, because I know you don't want to take blood pressure medication, but if your blood pressure stays high for too long, you eventually lose the ability to maintain an erection. Please check your blood pressure.
Yeah.
Medical minute done.
Yeah. And that was the medical minute with Brian. And now for MeUndies. I personally wouldn't buy any MeUndies because why? I've never worn them. I don't know anyone who ever buys them. They must be just fake as a company.
I have a pair. They're still
there's
good.
Currently one buyer of MeUndies in my memory. A very small amount. An unsuccessful firm.
I've had them for like a decade almost.
It's just crazy though. Like, who the fuck cares? Like dog? You know, like, it's a fucking, it's underwear. Like,
because I'll tell you what, I can tell the difference between a $5 pair of boxers and a $15 pair of boxers. That you can tell the difference.
There's a small difference. There's two companies I buy underwear from on Amazon, and I did a lot of fucking research because I hate buying underwear because it's just like, fuck it. You know, like, make it last as long as possible, especially if you're married and she doesn't give a shit. Yeah. So it's like, whatever, right? But all of them are not like as durable as they used to be. And there's some company on there called Bamboo Cool that makes boxer briefs, mm-hmm. and they're fucking great, dude. But they last like shit. Like, you know,
that's a problem.
Two, 3 months in, you gotta send them to like, I think on like days, like if you go over day 70. I think they like shatter into ash, kind of like a vampire in the sunshine. I think it's a selling point.
Just fall apart.
Steve's over here. You know, call me an asshole. Call me an asshole for having like MeUndies, like la-di-da, while he's darning his boxer shorts.
Bro, I got like five pairs of undies over your one pair of MeUndies with Slimer from Ghostbusters on them.
Disintegrating.
This guy's got the Roosevelt thong with the Sandlot characters lovingly printed on it.
You had to sew all five pairs of those together, and then they disintegrated well after.
It's like Castlevania 2. I put them together in the wrong order.
They disintegrated while you were wearing them. Like, they fell apart.
Oh, shit.
To your mailbox.
Exactly. Whoops.
But speaking of things falling apart,
maybe? Speaking of people whose balls dropped. Because they're disintegrating Chinese underwear.
Well, today, boys,
that's a good band name.
We're going to be talking about one James Jesus Angleton.
James Jesus Angleton?
Yes.
Are you saying that like trying to be funny? Is he like just named James Angleton and he was like?
Well, his middle name is Jesus, and I believe it's Jesus because his mother was Mexican American. She was naturalized. It's gotta be Jesus. So it's probably Jesus.
It has to be Jesus if his mom was Mexican American.
But James Jesus Angleton was born on December 9th, 1917, in Boise, Idaho. He was the eldest of four children of James Hugh Angleton.
You have to give me a real story here because It's not starting off real well.
Drop okay? for this, man.
Not starting off real well. Not very interesting. Some schmuck from Boise. Let's go.
Who is this clown, this potato farmer? Like, what did he do? Why should I care about old James Jesus Angleton?
We'll get to that. And Carmen, and his mother was Carmen Mercedes Moreno.
No. Nah, right, she, right,
his,
no way.
His mother
so
was
his mom's down there running the Bolita. Okay.
She was a stripper, her.
Joey Coco Diaz knows her. Yeah. I'm telling you, dog, she was in her 70s, but she gave great helmet.
All the boys in the neighborhood knew Carmen.
I was just over there, and I just had Coke boogers falling out of my nose.
Did you just call it fucking helmet?
Yeah, you never saw Spaceballs? When he pulls up his thing and they're looking at the princess and he goes, I heard she gives great helmet.
I totally just blanked on that fucking
bro, that, yeah, that's not on me. I'm not that suave.
His parents met in Nogales, Arizona. Well, his father was in the U.S. Army Cavalry serving under General John Pershing.
Wow, General Pershing.
She had been born in Mexico, but was already a naturalized American citizen.
Wait, what year was it?
Before she, they met in 19. They got married in 1916.
Because that's after World War II or
1916.
It's like before America entered World War II.
Okay. I mean World War One.
Right. World War One. Yes.
Yeah. Well, I was like, boys, what the fuck?
No, I didn't mean World War II. Sorry. I meant World War One.
Also, the fact that you have not mentioned what his mother did for a profession, but his dad was in the army. She was 100% a prostitute.
Well, I mean, you got to put bread on the table, you know. Back then,
hey, listen, sex work.
She wasn't allowed to vote or have a job, so it's like, you know, basically, if a husband left their wife back then and left them to suffer, it should be a death sentence because that's what he did to his wife, you know.
Basically,
essentially, right? I'd support that death penalty. Fuck that. But
James Hugh Angleton joined the National Cash Register Corporation, would rise through its ranks, and eventually purchased the franchise for the company in Italy in the early 1930s.
Did they purchase it on a cash register?
Ding.
Here's your change. Would also 35 and 7 is 20. Here you go.
He would also become the head of the American Chamber of Commerce in Italy. Angleton would spend his childhood in Milan, Italy. He studied as a boarder at Malvern College in England before attending Yale University. As a Yale undergraduate, he edited the Yale literary magazine Furioso with John Whitmore. It published the best-known poets of the interwar period, including William Carlos Williams, E.E. Cummings, and Ezra Pound.
That's one of those. That's one of those whack guys' names, you know, like Jerk Nowitzki, the Gooner guy, Ezra Pound.
Angleton carried on extensive correspondence with Pound, Cummings, and T.S. Eliot. Among
There's
others.
No way all these fucking names are real together. Dude, bro, stop it.
T.S. Eliot is maybe like one of the most celebrated authors ever from here.
And he was particularly
also,
influenced.
Fuck the Wasteland, by the way. I'm a little late on this, you know, considering it was released around then. It's like fuck that book. Oh, it's complicated. Yeah, it's fucking complicated. You need to have three other encyclopedias next to you to reference everything, figure out what the fuck he's talking about. It's ridiculous. It really was too, because it was an experimental novel. It was like it's basically gibberish. It's not like Jabberwocky, but it's it's more intelligently written. But it's like purposefully vague. So it's like reading Finnegan's Wake.
He was influenced by William Empson, the author of Seven Types of Ambiguity.
Just seven? That's not it's not very accurate.
Which is like an influential work of literary criticism, and it's considered to be one of the most influential works of literary criticism of the 20th century.
Hmm. So it's not like Seven Habits of
Obviously, they haven't read my poems.
I'm going to go out on a limb here, Ryan, and say that he was not a fan of that type of thing, as we get to his later life.
Wait, so he's not a fan of the Seven Habits of Highly Effective People?
Yeah, probably not, because I'll just spoil it here. He was a massive alcoholic and chain smoker.
Okay, but you already said that he came up in like the early 1900s, so that just kind of is a baseline. So,
he was considered to be like his drinking habits were like wilder than his peers. he was like the type of person that like in the Madman era that they would sort of be like, yeah, I think he needs to cut back.
He's like one of those dudes that like was so insane that the Nazis were like, guy, slow down. What are you doing? Like, I know we were the Nazis, but Jesus Christ, guys. Like that level of alcoholism.
I mean, he was trusted by a lot of people, so he was at least functional.
But he's not like Bukowski.
I think the level, we'll get to sort of his life, like the things that come up. And like, I kind of feel like a lot of it's kind of explained by the fact that he's like a raging alcoholic by some of the conclusions he jumps to.
I mean, generally speaking, that's not a very good start.
Correct. It's also a really good frame of reference to give us before you start into this, and know that he's a raging alcoholic.
But Angleton was trained in the New Criticism at Yale by Maynard Mack and others, chiefly Norman Holmes Pearson, who's a founder of American Studies. He would briefly study law at Harvard, but did not graduate.
Did that guy, Maynard Mack, was that his second time coming to Yale? Would it be the return of the Mack?
Return of the Mack. Return of the Mack. Return of the Mack.
He says return of the Mack way too much in return of the Mack.
Way too many times, dog.
Return of the
Mack. In 1943, Angleton would join the U.S. Army. During World War II, he would serve in the Office of Strategic Services and led its Italian branch. He also served in London under Norman Holmes Pearson in the X-2 counter-espionage branch of the OSS.
What?
The OSS, like the precursor to the CIA, yeah?
Yeah.
Yes. By February 1944, he was chief of the Italy desk for X-2 in London. While in London... Well, you know, that's what you keep them thinking. You release the papers on X1 and X3, but then they ask, what about X2? So while in London, Angleton would become friends with one Kim Philby.
Do we know who that is?
Kim Philby is an agent in MI6 who will later become what is known as the Cambridge Five.
Oh, shit. Another thing I don't know. Fuck.
Is this like the is this like Peter Stormare?
The Cambridge Five were five like major spies for the KGB. Kim Philby was the head of the like counter espionage division in MI6.
That sounds like I've seen a documentary or something on that guy.
He was slated. Yeah, there's a lot of documentaries and movies about him and such, and that. He was slated to become the head of MI6 before his cover got broken and he defected to the Soviet Union.
Okay.
But that's we're getting a little ahead of ourselves. By the end of the war, Angleton was the head of X2 for all of Italy. In this position, he helped prevent the execution of Italian naval commander Junio Valerio Borghese, whose elite unit, Decima MAS, had collaborated with the SS during the war.
Wow.
Angleton was interested in the defense of installations such as ports and bridges and offered Borghese a fair trial in return for his collaboration.
Steve, I got to give you a plus on that pronunciation there, pal. Fantastic.
Perfect.
Borghese.
He dressed him up in an American uniform and drove him from Milan to Rome for interrogation by the Allies. Borghese, though, would in 1970 take part in a planning of a neo-fascist coup.
You're freewheeling the name now, okay? You're the Borghese, and now you're from fucking Central Jersey, for Christ's sake. I was down there over on Division Street with Borghese, and we decided to go ahead and break into Mama Lucas, you know? Took the register and got out of there.
He was involved in a neo-fascist coup dubbed Golpe Borghese. And was called off after the press discovered it. He would flee to Spain and spend the rest of his life there in exile. Angleton remained in Italy after the war, establishing connections with other intelligence services and playing a major role in the 1948 Italian general election. The U.S.-backed Central Christian Democratic Party won the election over the Soviet-backed Italian Communist Party. Angleton's tour in Italy as an intelligence officer is regarded by a biographer of his, Jefferson Morley, as a critical turn not only in his professional life, but also in his personal life, as he would begin to liaison with Italian mafia figures who would help the CIA in the immediate post-war period. So he's one of the people that started building, like, alliances with the mafia that would come back in, like, you know, the Bay of Pigs and things we've talked about before.
Yeah.
God, it's crazy to see how, like, in bed the mafia was with the CIA. That's crazy.
They were more powerful than the CIA in Italy. So it's like, yeah.
I mean, I would almost venture to say they were also more powerful than the CIA in the United States.
Because
they had people in the CIA.
In the early 1900s, mafia. Yeah. Sicilia Mafia was pretty fucking crazy. But
they're popping off.
But they were
upon returning.
They were pretty powerful in Italy. They were more like fucking demigods. In America, they were just kind of like, I'd say, like countywide power. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Upon his return to Washington after World War II, Angleton was employed by the various successor organizations to the OSS. And eventually became one of the founding officers of the Central Intelligence Agency in 1947.
Wow. Was he in the war at all?
Well, yeah, I just said he was in charge of special operations for Italy.
Oh, okay. Okay. Sorry.
Like he was like he was counterintelligence and like
a small part in the war.
Yeah, he was probably somewhat involved in the killing of Mussolini.
Oh, nice. That's good. Good on him.
Because the OSS helped out the Italian resistance.
I'm all for anyone who gives us a good worldly example on how you deal with fascists. You know,
love you some anti-fascists. Yeah. Love them. Hey, can I ask a stupid question?
Yeah.
Why was Benito Mussolini hung upside down? Was there like any sort of symbolism to that, or was it just like, bro, fuck you?
It was literally a slap in the face, I think.
I think it was just a fuck you.
It was just a, you know, okay. Italians are good at that.
Just to hang him up. Well, it's like the way you hang an animal.
They got 50 fucking million forms of fuck you.
It's the same way you'd hang an animal.
Yeah.
Like and, if you were like field dressed an animal, you hang them head down.
And people, and again, that's how hateful and angry Italians get. It's like, I'm going to hang them like a fucking pig and just fucking hang them upside down. And then those people that just like give his daughter that's on.
Granddaughter.
His granddaughter that's on like Twitter. Man, she gets fucking annihilated by people on there.
She's so fucking crazy. I love when people like post pictures of her upside down. I die laughing.
She's like, "You have no taste," and it's like, "Bitch, fuck you."
Shut up. Shut up.
Your man was a piece of shit. Everybody knows it.
Well, she's a fascist too. So, like, she's literally a fascist politician.
Might as well be.
She ran for office, if I'm not mistaken, for like the Italy's like far right party.
I think she held local office.
Called fascist. Now it's called MAGA.
Yeah.
Why do we have to use a different word? It's just a dog whistle.
No, now it's just called Republican.
It's fucking dog whistle.
In May of 1949, he was made head of Staff A of the Office of Special Operations, where he was responsible for the collection of foreign intelligence and liaising with counterpart intelligence organizations in foreign countries.
I want to feel like he had like a bunch of tubes that he just kept having to fill with certain countries' intelligence. You know, like, oh, the Latvian tube's getting a little low.
I gotta go on a quick trip. I'll be back.
We need more intelligence. Okay. Bus station, new, brand new, actually. Just got built. Great.
They have to, like, he's in charge of getting the broom to, like, knock the canister in the pneumatic tube if it gets stuck.
Hey, Charlie, the vault canister's stuck again. Oh, Jesus Christ. All right.
Beginning in 1951, Angleton was responsible for the Israel desk.
Watching my Laurel and Hardys.
As a liaison with Israel's Mossad and Shin Bet agencies.
Mossad was around then? That was the 50s, right? Almost.
Yeah.
Yeah, so they were definitely
Israel
around.
Exists.
Yeah.
Unfortunately.
Angleton retained an active interest in Israeli intelligence and maintained connections there throughout his career. believing that emigres to Israel from the Soviet Union and Warsaw Pact nations could be a valuable source of information on their countries of origin.
Wow, he's a genius. Also believed...
What?
I said, wow, he's a fucking genius.
He also believed that Israeli foreign intelligence services could be used for proxy operations in third world countries.
Well, that was successful. Holy shit, that was super successful.
For instance,
if you think they'll jail you for Charlie Kirk, start saying something about Israel.
Oh, God. Oh, my God. Yeah, dude, we'll get taken off every fuck. I'm not going to say shit about Israel, boy. We'll get taken off of these podcast channels.
Yep.
You'll be guest starring on Candace Owens.
I saw all that shit with Kimmel. I really hope he sues. He should sue the federal government. He's almost has as much of a solid case as Tylenol. Which whole fucking thing is ridiculous.
Tylenol has a way better case.
Yeah, Tylenol has a bulletproof case. It's fucking ridiculous. You should be proud of your boy. I did not engage, but several times today I wanted to make a Tylenol joke in front of a conservative friend. I had. Just like,
oh God!
I'll be right back. I got Tylenol. My leg hurts.
I like that. Did you see the press conference where they brought up that the Gynecological Association said that the Tylenol's safe?
Yeah.
And then Trump was pretty much like, they're probably right.
I love
he literally
that.
Said he they're probably right.
Yeah, they're probably right. We don't
no, really? Did he actually say that? That is ridiculous.
Yeah, he was rambling on. He's like, that's what some people are saying. And he's like, they're probably right.
What did he say in that one fucking video I sent you guys?
But you know this guy.
We know what he said at the UN. It
sounds
right?
like he has one HP really, when he talks.
He said, "I'm really
He's
good
the one
at this
that
stuff."
Over a weekend, figured it out.
Your countries are going to hell. He said that to all of them, and his teleprompter died, so he just went on this rambling rant. And I guess apparently there was no reaction. Everyone was just sitting there in silence. Like
people laughed at him.
This is what he said.
It was worse than the last time he talked at the UN.
He said about the Tylenol, he said, nothing bad can happen. It can only good happen. But with the Tylenol, don't take it. Nothing bad can happen. It can only good happen. But with Tylenol, don't take it.
Just insane, bro.
It's fucking ridiculous. I'm just gonna say, there's not even... It was crazy, right? I read the study, and then I read the upper part of it. I don't need to read the math. And then I put it through ChatGPT. Fuck you. All right. It was the quickest way to do it. And just asked a couple questions of the document. And it's ridiculous, basically, what they did. They basically, in the test that they're using as examples, they didn't include siblings. Like if someone had a fucking brother or sister, and how that would fucking affect the outcome of this analysis. And as soon as they account for siblings in the equation, there's nothing. Zero data, right? It's essentially 100% fallacious to make the comments they made. You're just lying. You're telling people stop signs are green. It's ridiculous.
Again, I cannot wait until whoever it is, whatever pharmaceutical company makes Tylenol. And I hate that I'm even going to have to root for somebody, but I hope they bury this administration.
Also, Tylenol is not even a great drug. It's more specific for fever and shit, you know? It's like headaches and stuff. Way better stuff.
Just take ibuprofen if you don't have ulcers. You're fine.
Yeah, exactly.
This is not medical advice.
Yeah, this is not medical advice, and will not be taken as such anyway. Now for MeUndies again.
An example of collaboration between the CIA and Shin Bet was the obtaining of the transcript of Khrushchev's 1956 secret speech to the Communist Party that denounced Joseph Stalin.
Yeah, it wasn't a very effective speech, if we all know about it. Secret, huh?
Yeah, it was talked all about on our podcast. It's definitely not secret.
Who posted my speech on r/Russia?
the author, Samuel Katz, has claimed that Angleton directed CIA assistance to the Israeli nuclear weapons program.
Ooh.
Uh-oh. Getting heated.
As the head of Staff A, Angleton worked very closely with Kim Philby, who was seen as the apparent future head of MI6,
who was also in Washington. The Trilby, because that's what he wore.
Guarantee you he did.
Philly Trilby.
The Israeli intelligence officer Teddy Kollek claimed years later that in 1950 he warned Angleton that Philby had been a Soviet agent in the 1930s.
All right. So this Israeli guy,
somebody else paid for all those strobes,
saying that hey, your guy's a double agent.
Yeah, that's what this guy's
saying. Somebody else paid for Philby's trilbies. That's what he's saying.
In 1951, Philby's colleagues Guy Burgess and Donald McLean defected to Moscow.
Don McLean, huh? Great American folk singer. Oh shit! Yeah, I was there with Philby. You just like hear him on like 2020. And what was that? What was that like, Don? Well, you know, somebody else was paying for the trilbies, so. He's still alive. Response, holy shit. Don McLean's still alive.
All I heard was McLean, and I was like, boy, your grandson is going to do some crazy shit at Nakatomi Tower in a couple decades.
Nah, man, the American pie guy.
Yeah.
Not the one that fucked the pie, but the one who sung about the pie before it was about fucking pie. You know? That American pie guy. The one that was heavy and like
Jason,
our parents'
Jason
age.
Big, the other one.
Yeah. Not the one that fucks pies, yeah.
Philby would be expelled from Washington, suspected of having tipped them off based on a decoded Soviet communications recovered as part of the papers from the Venona Project, which was a surveillance project of Soviet communiques.
What year was this?
This is 1951.
Oh, okay.
Philby was confirmed to be a Soviet mole, but would elude those who were sent to arrest him. He would defect to Moscow in 1963.
So they let him slip through their fingers, huh?
Philby called Angleton a brilliant opponent and a fascinating friend who seemed to be catching on before his defection.
And a snappy dresser.
opponent?
Well, yeah, because he's a double agent.
Yeah, but that doesn't mean he's necessarily your opponent. Like the nation you're spying on would be like your opponent. I guess.
He's the United States is the enemy of the Soviet Union, and Angleton is the communist hunter in the United States for the CIA.
Okay, all right, that's fair.
that's the job of counterintelligence. And before the end of the Cold War, is you are the guy who finds communist spies in the United States.
Okay. Reduced down to brass tacks. Nice.
But,
nice.
The CIA employee, William King Harvey, who was a former FBI agent, had voiced his suspicions regarding Philby and others Angleton suspected were Soviet agents.
Sounds like a fucking WWF wrestler from the 80s, William King Harvey.
Like, how do you suspect somebody's a Russian double agent? Like, you walk in the break room and he's like sitting there, like, yes.
I noticed he was putting vodka into his coffee as opposed to normal American whiskey.
Yeah, there'd be much more telltale signs. I notice he sweats in winter.
There's like walking by his cubicle is like the Russian national anthem's playing, or like the Soviet like Soviet hymns are just like echoing through a radio.
I noticed he has the Russian flag on his face. You know,
yes,
he has like good morning, comrade.
He has like a Tiger Beat picture of Khrushchev up in his cubicle.
Tiger Beat. Oh shit, son, Tiger Beat. Do they even make those fucking magazines anymore? Those shitty ass girl mags.
I don't think so.
I think that's all gone, right?
I think print media is dead. So.
Yeah, it's just it's interesting
Publix,
to me.
Publix still has an entire aisle of magazines.
Dude,
so
listen, I like a good magazine. The problem is you can't be working that magazine too long because then you start piling up magazines, you know?
Yeah, so I love a good magazine, though, too.
Yeah, just give me, like, especially if it's about something I'm interested in. Like, I get ham radio magazines, brother. Fantastic.
Give me a good GQ with a good article in it, and I'm set for a couple days.
It's good, right? Yeah, it's good.
Yeah.
I like I'm also not a fan of all of it, but like I like the Atlantic and the New Yorker and all that shit.
I'm a fan of the New Yorker. I like the New Yorker. Also, not trying to be funny, I like Playboy, obviously for the tits, but yes, they do actually still have really good articles in Playboy every now and then.
Yeah, I always found, you know, not to get into it, but I always found Playboy like tits to be too manicured for my taste, you know?
Yeah.
Too perfect.
Like I said, Yeah. Like I said, it's you know, I'm a dude. I'm not going to sit here and like try
no,
to make...
No, I also read it for the same reason.
There's boobs. It's awesome.
Yeah, bro, like, I read it for the same reason. We're on the same page.
But they have, legitimately have had good articles in there. Like, I think they probably peaked in, like, the 90s, 2000s with, like, their actual, like, hard-hitting reporting. But they still do occasionally come out with, like, decent articles that I will see get referenced in other places. And I'll be like, oh, fuck, they actually have a good... All right, let me go buy this month. Sorry. Twist my arm to go buy this magazine of tits and good reporting. Sorry.
In 1953, Alan Dulles became director of Central Intelligence.
Tits and good reporting describes, like, the best, like, Spanish weather station, you know?
Oh, dude.
like the one with the highest record.
Dude, Mexican meteorologists are so hot.
Oh, my God. It's just, it's crazy. It's ridiculous.
It's unreal.
He soon named Angleton chief of counterintelligence staff. And this is a position Angleton would serve for the remainder of his career in the CIA. As chief of counterintelligence, Angleton oversaw a ring of informants organized by Jay Lovestone, a trained union leader and former head of the Communist Party of the United States. This was informally called the Lovestone Empire. And Lovestone worked with foreign unions and used covert funds to establish a global system of anti-communist union organizers.
Okay.
During the Vietnam War and Soviet American detente, Angleton remained convinced of the necessity of the war. During this period, his counterintelligence staff undertook a comprehensive domestic covert surveillance project called Operation Chaos under the direction of President Lyndon Johnson.
Old big dick Lyndon.
The prevailing belief at the time was that the anti-war and civil rights movements of the 60s and 70s had foreign funding and support. None was found by this operation, although the Soviet Union did influence the movement somewhat.
So you didn't find any evidence of it, although they did do it. Like what?
Well, no, there's like that they were looking for like them actually like, giving them money.
Uh-huh.
Like they were only being like influenced by like Soviet like propaganda. They were not influenced. Essentially, what I'm saying is that they were not like bought and paid for by the Soviet Union, which is the argument they're making. They were saying these people aren't legitimate. That they're just like working for the money of the Soviets.
Got you. Okay.
The CIA was charged with the illegal collection, correlation, and evaluation of intelligence. While the act does not specify a prohibition on collecting domestic intelligence or a restriction to only collect foreign intelligence, Executive Order 1-333 of 1981 added prohibitions to limit CIA activities. So this is before then.
Right. Okay.
The CIA began domestic recruiting operations in 1959 in the process of finding Cuban exiles who could be used in the campaign against Cuba and President Fidel Castro. As these operations expanded, the CIA formed a domestic operations division in 1964. In 1965, President Johnson requested that the CIA begin its own investigation into domestic dissent, which I described above, independent of the FBI's ongoing COINTELPRO, which conducted similar activities.
COINTELPRO.
The CIA
all had numerous together.
COINTELPRO, you're wrong.
I just added another thread to my board. It's all coming together, boys.
The CIA developed numerous operations targeting American dissidents in the U.S. Many of these programs operated under the CIA's Office of Security, including H.T. Lingual, which directed at letters passing between the United States and the Soviet Union. The program involved the examination of correspondence to and from individuals or organizations placed on a watch list. Project 2 was directed at the infiltration of foreign intelligence targets by agents posing as dissident sympathizers, and which, like Chaos, had placed agents within domestic radical organizations for training and establishment of dissident credentials. Project Merrimack, which was designed to infiltrate domestic anti-war and radical organizations thought to pose a threat to security of CIA property and personnel, and Project Resistance, which worked with college administrators, campus security, and local police to identify anti-war activists and political dissidents without any infiltration taking place. When Nixon came to office in 1969, these existing domestic surveillance activities were consolidated into Operation Chaos.
Oh, why don't we just take all these bells and put them in one bell? Oh, that's my Nixon.
Operation Chaos would first use CIA stations abroad to report on anti-war activities of American citizens traveling abroad, employing methods such as physical surveillance and electronic eavesdropping, utilizing quote-unquote liaison services, and maintaining such surveillance. These operations were later expanded to include 60 officers, and in 1969, following the expansion, the operation began developing its own network of informants for the purposes of infiltrating various foreign anti-war groups located in foreign countries that might have ties to domestic groups.
God, what a waste of money and time. Actually, that's probably ignorant. There's probably some benefit.
Eventually, the CIA officers expanded the program to include other leftist or countercultural groups with no discernible connection to Vietnam, such as groups operating within the Women's Liberation Movement. The domestic spying of Operation Chaos also targeted the Israeli embassy and domestic Jewish groups such as B'nai B'rith. To gather intelligence on the embassy and B'nai B'rith, the CIA purchased a garbage collection company to collect documents that that were to be destroyed.
Where was that?
Tell me that was Jersey. I believe it's in New York.
It doesn't even bat an eye that they would buy a garbage disposal truck unit thing in New York.
Oh man.
Targets all mobbed up as the stereotype went. All the trash guys are mobbed up.
Oh yeah.
Specific target.
I know a story, but yeah. I'm not gonna tell it here.
There we go.
Targets of Operation Chaos within the anti-war movement included the Students for a Democratic Society, the Black Panther Party, the Young Wards, Women's Strike for Peace, and Ramparts magazine.
I love the Black Panther Party. I think Ramparts is probably my favorite wicked magazine.
God damn.
It's just one of those words that always sounds like very Boston to me. Everybody had a Ramparts.
Ramparts. Too bad it's talking about L.A.
Yeah.
At its final state, Operation Chaos contained files on 7,200 Americans and a computer index totaling 300,000 civilians and approximately 1,000 groups.
Yeah, but the real crime here, Steve, is that they took the name Operation Chaos and made it something fucky. You know, like it should have been something cool. Yeah. You know, something fucking cool.
Angleton also believed that the strategic calculations underlying the resumption of relations with China were flawed based on a deceptive KGB staging of the Sino-Soviet split. So you believe that the Sino-Soviet split is fake?
It's fake. Not real. Nah.
Remind me, just because I don't know what the fuck I'm talking about, what is a Sino-Soviet split?
It's when the Soviet Union and Communist China became enemies after the secret speech, because Khrushchev denounced Stalin. And Mao's like, no, we follow the Stalin model. I'm following the Stalin model. And then so they became enemies. Like, the Soviet Union almost declared nuclear war on China in, like, 1969. Like, really? They came very close to invading them, yes.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy.
Really? Just because China was like, we're sticking with Stalin's model?
There were border clashes, and there was a lot of antagonism between them. Mm-hmm. And it got to a point of breakdown of relations where it was possible that a war could have broken out.
That is like, fucking crazy.
Like, are you familiar with the movie The Omega Man?
No.
It's a Charlton Heston movie. It's based off I Am Legend. But essentially, the plot of the war is that this biological like virus like kills most of the human race. Except for him, who's the last one left, and it turns the other ones into these like mutants who are like sensitive to sunlight. But the precipitating factor of the war, which is a movie from the early 70s, is a war between the Soviet Union and Communist China. Like when the U.S. became allies with Communist China, like if World War III broke out in like the 80s, like China would have been our ally. Like they would have invaded the Soviet Union with us.
Really?
Yeah, because there's even a line about it in Red Dawn.
I was about to say, because like movies like Red Dawn and all that is like what, you know, as an 80s baby, what I grew up on. So that like the Soviet Union was always like the big bad. Even in Mighty Ducks, it was always like the Soviet Union. It was like the Russians. It was like those were always, and you just never really thought about China ever.
Because they make a remark about China being their ally in the war in Red Dawn. And he says like millions of Chinese. And they make the comment, well, I thought there was a billion. He says there were, implying that the Soviet Union used like nuclear weapons on them.
Okay.
There were a billion.
No, he doesn't even do that. He just he pours alcohol on the fire when he says that, when he just says there were.
Oh my God.
Causing it to like flare up. So he even went so far as to believe that Henry Kissinger was under the influence of the KGB.
Yeah, that's what Christ. I'm going to call it if I drink when I'm angry, pouring alcohol on the fire. That's such a good way to say it.
Angleton's view was influenced by his direct experience with the manipulation of German intelligence during World War II, the Cambridge Five that I mentioned, and the success of American infiltration efforts in the Third World.
Cambridge Five sounds like a rap group quintet.
But because Angleton had been so close with Philby, that this made Angleton, who's already paranoid, to become even more paranoid, and that he just began to like believing everybody was like a Soviet double agent.
Hey, yo, Angie.
Paranoia. There it is.
But Angleton, though, his position in the CIA and his close relationship with then-director Richard Helms expanded his influence. And as it grew, the CIA would split between what were called the Angletonians and the anti-Angletonians.
Jesus Christ.
Fucking Angletonians. That sounds like a type of mitts, you know? These are the Angletonians. We get them in the kitchen for when we handle beef.
This conflict rose in particular in regards to Anatoly Golitsyn and Yuri Nosenko, who defected from the Soviet Union to the United States in 1961 and 1964, respectively.
These aren't real names. They're not.
Anatoly Golitsyn? Yeah, that's a real name. I've heard that name before many times.
Golitsyn defected via Helsinki on December 15, 1961. He and his family flew with a CIA escort to Sweden and then to the United States, where he was interviewed by Angleton personally.
Who was Angleton personally?
Oh my God.
Golitsyn limited his initial debriefing to a review of photographs to identify KGB officers and refused to discuss KGB strategy. After Golitsyn raised the possibility of serious infiltration with MI5 in a subsequent debriefing, MI5 shared the concern with Angleton. He responded by asking Helms to allow him to take responsibility for Golitsyn and his further debriefing. Golitsyn ultimately informed on many famous Soviet agents, including the Cambridge Five, which led to their apprehension.
Look, I'll stick up for Golitsyn. All right. Sure. Sure thing, Charlie.
Angleton would identify Golitsyn as the most valuable defector ever to reach the West.
What he's basically saying is he's the most valuable snitch.
Yeah.
But other allegations Golitsyn made, including that Prime Minister of the UK, Harold Wilson, was a Soviet agent, and that the Sino-Soviet split was a charade, were ultimately found to be false.
Just throwing shit against the wall at that point and see what stuck.
Well, to say Harold Wilson was a Soviet spy is that he was a Labor prime minister. And, like, but he was, like, while he was still, like, an old Labor guy, he was still, like, it's like, essentially saying, like, Bernie Sanders is, like, personally working for, like, the Kremlin level of, like, of, like, if we elect this man, he's gonna turn it into, like, Stalin's Russia level of, like, insane,
okay.
Like...
Okay, yeah, all right, that's insane.
Golitsyn has claimed that a mole who had been stationed in West Germany was of Slavic descent, had a last name that might end in sky, and definitely began with a K and operated under the KGB codename Sasha.
Kaspersky.
Angleton believed this claim.
A young Gary Kaspersky.
With the result that anyone who approximated this description fell under his suspicion.
He just hated Polacks, that's all.
Ooh.
His last name begins with a K, ends with ski. Oh, yeah. Man.
Well, it begins with S-K-I, and then they're Polish. S-K-Y, they tend to be Russian.
Engelton became increasingly convinced the CIA was compromised by the KGB. Galitzin convinced him that the KGB had organized in 1958 and 1959 to consist mostly of a shell
KGB
incorporating only those
kick-ass girls bureau, and basically all it was a bunch of dudes who got up to review the local porno mags. That's all. Look at this girl, she's kick-ass.
They just got together to read the Playboys for the articles.
Oh shit. Did you guys know how to make highball with grape knee high? How amazing is
this
that?
Guy,
grape
this guy,
knee high
Hugh,
and highball.
This guy, Hugh, he has many ladies. I like to be like
he
Hugh.
He looks like he has no job either, so what is secret?
All he do is smoke and drink. He's
I think
living
that's
Russian
it.
Dream.
I wear a fine
silk robe. I smash blonde woman.
I believe that his silk robe has the power. It attracts the women. You never see him without it. He goes to court.
But Galitzin convinced Engelton that the KGB had organized a shell of agents whom the CIA and FBI were recruiting, directed by a small cabal of puppet masters who doubled those agents to manipulate their Western counterparts.
Oh my god. That's what we're gonna fucking hear on the news any day now, that the FBI's taking down a cabal of puppet masters.
So basically he's saying that like the KGB knew that there were people in their ranks the CIA and FBI were going for, and they kind of pulled them off to the side and just kind of dictated what they could be fed.
Well, they're just sort of like making like prime candidates for the FBI and CIA, like finding them and like grabbing them first, yeah, and like getting them on their side, like essentially recruiting them like, before the FBI or KGB and making sure that they get in.
Okay.
Because although Galitzin was a very questionable source, Engelton accepted this information from Galitzin and believed it to be true.
Wait. Although he wasn't a credible source?
Yeah, he's not like he was okay. He was proven wrong on a bunch of things. Like,
okay,
but
I got you.
But
I
Angleton's
you.
Like, yeah, like this guy, everything
no,
he
this
says
is my boy,
is true.
I fuck with him. Let's go.
Which is again like prime alcoholic behavior.
Yeah. No, I liked what he said originally, and I'm here for it. My heart's in it.
I'm in it to win it, baby. Let's go.
I'm in it. Let's go.
Slurring his speech. No, goalie wouldn't do that, man.
There's no way. He's not no commie. I know, okay?
In 1964, Yuri Nosenko, a KGB officer based in Geneva, insisted he needed to defect to the United States because his role as a double agent had been discovered and he was being recalled to Moscow.
Martha, we gotta get the fuck out of here.
Nosenko was allowed to defect, although the CIA was unable to verify a KGB recall order. Galitzin had said from the beginning that the KGB would try to play defectors in an effort to discredit him. So under duress, Nosenko failed two highly questionable lie detector tests, but passed a third test monitored by several agency departments. Judging his claims, as well as additional claims regarding Lee Harvey Oswald, to be improbable, Engelton permitted David Murphy, head of the Soviet Russia division, to hold Nosenko in solitary confinement for over 3 years.
Jesus Christ.
This confinement included 16 months in a small attic with no windows, furniture, heat, or air conditioning. Human contact was completely banned. Nosenko was given a shower once a week and had no television, reading material, radio, exercise, or toothbrush.
Wow.
Interrogations were frequent and intensive. Nosenko spent an additional 4 months in a 10-foot-by-10-foot concrete bunker in Camp Perry.
Jesus. He
was told that his condition would continue for 25 years unless he confessed to being a Soviet spy. Nosenko did not appear to have shaken Angleton's faith in Galitzin, although Helms and J. Edgar Hoover thought otherwise. J. Edgar Hoover's objections were said to be so vehement as to severely curtail counterintelligence operation or cooperation between the FBI and CIA for the remainder of Hoover's service as FBI director.
They were so vehement for what?
That he was so angry and like thought this was so ridiculous that he refused to cooperate on counterintelligence. Wow. Because he thought Angleton was like a madman. Like he thought like this is so like when J. Edgar Hoover looks at this and says, this is fucking ridiculous. What are we doing?
That's insane when J. Edgar Hoover says that.
Yeah. I mean, he's down for whatever, you know, he settles
Hitler
in.
Looked at Goebbels and
he
was
gets
like,
out of that suit, you know, and gets into some nice pink, like MeUndies, you know, for women. Then he gets real comfy.
Nosenko was found to be a legitimate defector, a lieutenant colonel in the KGB.
Called it.
He became a consultant to the CIA. Galitzin, who had defected years before, was unable to provide concrete support for his views of the KGB.
That's concrete, baby.
Angleton would come into increasing conflict with the rest of the agency, particularly the Directorate of Operations, over the efficacy of their intelligence gathering efforts. He questioned this without explaining his broader views of KGB strategy and organization.
Your mans ain't shit, Bobby. You ain't shit.
You just gotta believe me, bro. Trust me, bro. Source, trust me, bro.
In his 2022 book, Uncovering Popoff's Mole, researcher John M. Newman argues that Bruce Salee of the Office of Security was very probably the mole, and that he misled Angleton, his protege, into believing the traitor was in the Soviet Russia division.
Oh, shit.
Nice.
Throughout the 1960s and 70s, Angleton privately accused various foreign leaders of being Soviet spies. He twice informed the Royal Canadian Mounted Police that he believed Prime Minister Lester Pearson and his successor Pierre Trudeau were agents of the Soviet Union.
So he definitely...
Trudeau...
lost his mind.
Trudeau of the same Justin fame?
Yeah, the father of Justin Trudeau.
Yep. Oh, okay.
It's actually his dad's idea that he wear blackface in those costumes.
Well, you know, he's old
school
French
Canadian.
It's
always funny to look like one of them dogs, you know?
Angleton accused Swedish Prime Minister.
Sorry, I get really mad when people talk about Justin Trudeau in a positive light. Like, he was a good politician. I guess he was a piece of shit in a lot of ways too.
He's like Obama.
Yeah, he's like that guy that played Mad Men, the fucking actor.
He's just charismatic. That's all it is. He's just charismatic. That's all it is.
John Hamm.
Yeah, John Hamm. John Hamm's a piece of shit.
Is he for real?
Fuck yeah! Do you ever go read? Go look up John Hamm hazing incident. You find out
all right.
How much of a piece of shit he is. It's terrible.
Angleton accused Swedish Prime Minister Olaf Palm, West German Chancellor Willy Brandt, and British Prime Minister Harold Wilson of being assets of the Soviet Union.
So he's just going around calling people communists.
Yeah, any sort of like left of center politician, he's like, that man is a Soviet spy.
So it's like,
kill him now.
Right. It's like the MAGA movement right now, you know?
Yeah.
Like if you don't fall directly in line. They're like, it's about freedom as long as you do exactly what we say.
It's the people calling Joe Biden a communist.
Yeah. Oh my God.
That shit's wild to me.
It makes no sense. It makes no sense just from a numbers game. Donald Trump's been in bed with Russia since the 80s. If anyone would be a communist, it would be him. It doesn't make sense.
These people are stupid. Remember that.
It doesn't make sense. Biden lived his life in the public eye.
If he was the agent of anyone, it was Israel.
Exactly. And on top of that, I don't even... What world are we in where Joe Biden, by the way, wasn't like a, almost like pseudo-racist kind of douchebag? I mean, you know, he was a fucking asshole politician until Obama kind of cleaned him up, basically, in my opinion.
Basically.
You know, because he gave him some credibility.
Australian journalist Brian Toohey claimed that Angleton considered Australian Prime Minister Gough Whitlam a serious threat to the U.S.,
Speaking of Tua, it made me think of the Miami Dolphins quarterback, which made me think about football, which made me realize that I picked Atlanta this past weekend. Oof. That's all I got to say. And so did 99% of all bettors across the
country,
I think. They lost 30-0. So I'm out of the goddamn eliminator, but my wife's still in, and since I paid, I get half of that, so hopefully she goes on.
Angleton,
this segment brought to you by Hard Rock Bets.
Always have a hedge.
Angleton was concerned after the Commonwealth Police raided the ASIO headquarters in Melbourne in 1973 at the direction of Attorney General Lionel Murphy.
I mean, we were all concerned. It was a crazy everybody time was. For everyone.
I clutched my pearls harder than anybody.
In 1974, Angleton sought to instigate the removal of Whitlam from office by having CIA station chief in Canberra, John Walker, ask Peter Barber, then head of ASIO, to make a false declaration that Whitlam had lied about the raid in Parliament. Barber refused to make the statement.
God damn, it's a lot of
just say he lied. Just say he lied, and everything's going to be all right with you. Everything's going to be upsies.
In 1973, William Colby was named director of the CIA by Richard Nixon. Colby reorganized the CIA in an effort to curb Angleton's influence and weaken the counterintelligence branch, beginning by stripping him of control over the Israel desk. Colby demanded Angleton's resignation. Angleton came to public attention when the Church Committee, formerly the Senate Committee...
Let me reconnoiter me, okay? Because I'm pretty fucking high. So this guy's kind of like a like half a fucking nut job, basically, just going around calling people communist, and he has a position of somewhat power, and he's just going off the fucking deep end.
Steve, he doesn't have a position of somewhat power. He has a position of major power in the CIA. We'll get to it. Like, we don't know the exact amount of people are in the CIA because it's classified information. Mm-hmm. But the counterintelligence staff, after what we're going to talk about next, goes from being 300 people to 80 people.
Jesus.
This guy had 300 people under him as staff.
That's fucking Christ. That's a lot of fucking spooks.
But Angleton would come to public attention with the Church Committee, formerly the Senate Select Committee to Study Governmental Operations with Respect to Intelligence Activities, probed the CIA for information on domestic surveillance, specifically the operation known as HT Lingual, as well as the assassination plots and the death of John F. Kennedy.
Okay, well, now, is the Church Committee largely looked upon as a positive political event?
Well, the church Committee reins in, like, the FBI and CIA. Like positive, it ends a lot. It's positive in the sense that essentially, like, from here on out, this prevents the CIA from spying on American citizens. It sort of sets in these guardrails of, like, what they can and cannot do.
Yeah, I thought, like, that's what it was about, that the Church Committee limited the CIA's power in the United States.
It also does things with, like, the FBI and its ability to work abroad, and it sort of sets these limits on, like, intelligence power.
But not who can lead it, you know?
Because it's currently run by a
gas station T-shirt hawker. So
that's why you have things like NYPD having international counterterrorist units instead of, like, the FBI. But the NYPD and the FBI closely work together, so I'm sure they're sharing information anyway. It's all a big, just, like, law enforcement net.
Yeah.
Like, it doesn't matter. You limit power one way, it's just going to pop up in another way. It's an unending game of whack-a-mole.
Yeah.
But in December of 1974, Seymour Hersh publishes a story in the New York Times about domestic counterintelligence activities against anti-war protesters and other domestic dissidents.
I love me a good Seymour Hersh novel.
Angleton's resignation was announced on Christmas Eve of 1974.
Angleton's.
Mr. President, can you say acetaminophen again?
Oh, my God. We're going to ban the acetaminophen.
Let's see if we can say this.
Listen, Grandpa, you're coming out here with a fucking breakthrough that, one, has no scientific literature backing it that makes any sense. Two, you're selling this as the big, like, thing, right? And you can't pronounce the fucking word? You didn't prepare, you fucking schlub shithead. Unbelievable, dude. Not even as bad. Like the most, literally the most embarrassing thing in U.S. history happened today. And, or it was today or yesterday when he spoke. I think it was today.
Yesterday.
It's the single most, watch 5 minutes of it and tell me you're not already like just absolutely embarrassed. Not even a gas station tough guy would find that to be a powerful leader. What a weak, disgusting pile of human shit he is.
Angleton's resignation was announced on Christmas Eve of 1974, just as President Gerald Ford demanded Director Colby report on the allegations in various congressional committees announced that they would launch their own inquiries.
Go ahead and get it done. That's my Christmas present.
No, it's we're on Gerald Ford.
Oh, we're on Gerald Ford?
Yeah. Angleton told...
Yes, Mr. President.
Angleton,
the last good president, goddammit.
Angleton Homer, told reporters from...
Do you actually, like no, football? Jimmy Carter,
not Gerald Ford, Jimmy Carter.
Angleton told reporters from the United Press International that he was resigning because, quote-unquote, my usefulness has ended and the CIA was getting involved in, quote-unquote, police state activities.
Is the United International a communist paper?
The United Press International is the UPI. It's just like, it's like,
okay,
it's like Reuters.
You know, like they call them the International, you know?
Right? It's like the AP.
Or is it the, no, it's the National, right, when the communists get together. They have their big like rallies. They call them the Nationals.
Well, they have like the Communist International is like a big conference.
That's what I'm talking about. Yeah, that's what I was asking.
Yeah.
Okay. Cool.
The counterintelligence. Three of Angleton's senior aides retired within a week after it was made clear that they would be transferred elsewhere in the agency rather than be promoted. And the counterintelligence staff
fuck
was reduced
that.
From
I run
300
ice cream.
To
everybody
80 people.
Knows Lenny runs ice cream.
That's the craziest thing to me is it goes down to 80 people from 300.
Yeah, I kind of overrode
that's
you there. So
nuts.
You said 300 to 80, right?
Yeah.
That's insane. That's fucking crazy.
In 1975, Angleton was awarded the CIA's Distinguished Intelligence Medal.
That's the easiest way to get him out, you know?
By this time, Angleton had been quietly rehired by the CIA at his old salary.
Oh, my God.
In September 1975, operational issues remained solely the preserve of Angleton.
So he still got to make... He was basically the shot caller still.
Yeah, they
more
still
like
quietly
brought
him back.
More like a wannabe baller, you know? Baller.
I think he drove an Impala.
Shot caller. Wannabe baller.
Which is a little bit taller.
And he was like
over there
seven,
getting
right?
head tonight on the highway. There's gotta be a better way. That's a good song. Man, fuck. I gotta find that.
The late 1970s were generally a period of upheaval for the CIA. During George H.W. Bush's tenure as director, President Ford authorized the creation of Team B, a project concluding that the agency and the intelligence community had seriously underestimated Soviet's strategic nuclear strength in Central Europe.
I thought you said Team
Admiral
B.
Stansfield Turner.
You know, like the shitty magazine.
No, Team B.
Gerald Ford used Team Beat to check the commies.
Admiral Stansfield Turner, on his appointment as DCI by President Jimmy Carter in 1977, used Angleton as an example of excesses in the agency that he hoped to curb. He referred to this during his service and in his memoirs. Because of their suspicions, Angleton and his staff ultimately impeded the career advancement of numerous CIA employees.
No kidding.
40 employees
can you,
are said.
Can you imagine being like, hey, listen, I'm about to get promoted. I'm about to make a shitload more money. And you got some drunk fucking alcoholic shitbag being like, he's caught me. God.
Well, it's not even that. It's like you're being accused of things that can get you either like put in jail for the rest of your life. Or like other like bad things. So it's not just like, oh, I'm not getting a promotion because this dickhead doesn't like me. It's like, no, this dickhead is like accusing me of like treason.
Wow.
I'm saying, can you imagine having to deal with that? And he's also, again, like just some fucking lush walking around.
Just spill it as G&T on the copy machine.
It's like tie half done, stumble around the office. He's just like,
oh, where did I put my Tangeray?
And you gotta like make good, like when he walks by, you gotta like fucking start like humming the national, the fucking Star Spangled Banner as soon as he starts walking by. Or like, you a communist? Like you're at the water fountain. He's just like walking with you, communist? Huh? And you're just like, no, fuck. Oh god damn it. Oh no. He's like, I'm just fucking with you.
I had to shoot my dog because it had a red rocket. Can't have that. Goddamn expensive dog too. I had to replace it.
40 employees are said to have been investigated, and 14 were considered serious suspects by his staff. The CIA would eventually pay compensation to three of these agents under what agency employees termed the Mole Relief Act. With Galitzin, Angleton continued to seek out moles within the CIA. They would seek the assistance of William F. Buckley Jr., who himself had formerly worked for the CIA, to write a book entitled New Lies for Old, which argued that the Soviet Union planned to fake a collapse to lull its enemies into a false sense of victory, but Buckley refused.
The fuck? Okay. Really? I figured Buckley would actually bite on that shit. He's a piece of shit.
Well, I think we're also in the early 90s, so it's very obvious, like, no, the Soviet Union is actually collapsing, you drunk dickhead.
Yeah.
In his 1994 book, Wedge, The Secret War Between the FBI and CIA, author Mark Riebling claimed that of 194 predictions made in New Lies for Old, 139 had been fulfilled by 1993. Nine seemed clearly wrong, and the other 46 were not seen falsifiable, or were not soon falsifiable.
I mean, that's still a shockingly high accuracy rate, if that's all true.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I mean, if you're the head of the CIA and you can like look at the intelligence, you're probably going to be right if you have like the main line to like the secret info that other people don't have, because it's also the 90s.
Yeah, but still, like, you wouldn't think that they would kind of disclose all that kind of shit like that. You know?
I mean, yes and no. It's just sort of things like, when you're the guy that investigates that, you can kind of do whatever you want.
I guess. Yeah, that's true.
You're like, yeah, I looked into myself, I'm fine.
Turns out I didn't do anything wrong, I don't know.
Angleton's responsibilities as chief of counterintelligence have given rise to a considerable literature focused on his efforts to identify Soviet or Eastern Bloc agents working in American intelligence agencies. Although in time, Angleton's zeal and suspicions came to be regarded as counterproductive, if not destructive. In the wake of his departure, counterintelligence efforts were undertaken with far less enthusiasm. Some believe this overcompensation was responsible for oversight.
I don't like doing this counterintelligence stuff anymore, you know? But I keep doing it. I'm just not very enthusiastic.
But his overcompensation was responsible for oversights that allowed Aldrich Ames, Robert Hansen, and others who were actual like foreign intelligence assets to compromise American intelligence agencies after his resignation.
Oh, my God.
Although the American Intelligence Committee quickly recovered from the Church Committee, it found itself uncharacteristically incapable of policing itself after his departure. Edward J. Epstein has argued that the positions of Ames and Hansen, both well-placed Soviet counterintelligence agents of the CIA and FBI respectively, would enable the KGB to deceive the American Intelligence Committee in the manner that Angleton hypothesized.
Listen, speaking of Epstein, there is a local doctor who's a podiatrist whose name is literally Jeffrey Epstein. And every time I see it on the specialist list, I just fucking laugh.
It's like actually not an uncommon name.
That's what I'm saying. I have to field the stupidest phone calls constantly. His office must. What's, oh, God.
What's like that, it's like that bit from SNL about the guy running for like NYC City Council and his name is Harvey Epstein. Mm-hmm. And like his whole ad is like no relation to either of them.
Oh my God.
Oh God! Can you imagine like being Jeffrey Epstein and like seeing the news and all this shit coming out? And you're just like, no fucking shot, bro. Or you're gonna see all this news coming out, and you're like, this is the time to advertise on Google, yes. baby. Have my name.
Yeah, you have to be one of these get these bread motherfuckers. You know?
No, no. That's what you get like credible attempts on your life, because it's like that one guy. Was it Matthew Gaetz? Anytime Matt Gaetz is in the news, he has to get on his Twitter. It's like I am not that man.
They literally hear like Matt Gaetz, you know. It's just like, what do you hear when people speak, motherfucker?
This name's close enough, fuck it.
Yeah. Gaetz, right? That's what you said.
I do not look like Beavis. I am not that man. Despite misgivings over his uncompromising and often obsessive approach to his profession, Angleton is highly regarded by a number of his peers in the intelligence business. The former Shin Bet chief, Amos Manor, in an interview in Haaretz, revealed his fascination with the man during Angleton's work to forge the U.S.-Israel liaison. What?
What's Shin Bet?
Shin Bet's like one of their intelligence services.
Oh, okay.
In the early 1950s, Manor described Angleton as a fanatic about everything with a tendency toward mystification. Manor discovered decades later that the real reason for Angleton's visit was to investigate Manor. Being an Eastern European Jewish immigrant, for Angleton thought that it would be prudent to quote-unquote sanitize the U.S.-Israeli bridge before a more formal intelligence relationship was established.
Wow. What a way to put it, quote, sanitize.
Gotta clean that shit up.
Three books dealing with Angleton take foreign intelligence activities, counterintelligence, and domestic intelligence activities as their central theme. Tom Mangold's Cold Warrior, David C. Martin's Wilderness of Mirrors, and David Wise's Mole Hunt. Tim Weiner's Legacy of Ashes paints Angleton as an incompetent alcoholic.
What's like the generally accepted conclusion?
I mean, I think the general conclusion is that he's mostly ineffective because of like his damaging impact on the agency and the fact that these like two prominent moles were able to like embed themselves and not be found until like decades later.
Which really is like, isn't that just a condemnation? I mean, like that should be the condemnation, like right there. Like, fuck you. You're terrible.
Yeah, it's basically what it is. It's you're terrible at your fucking job, that these people are here for decades, and your one job is to find them.
You had one job.
You had one fucking job, bro, and you couldn't even do that. You were drunkenly stumbling around the office accusing just normal people of being communists. Like, God, you're terrible.
These views have been challenged by Tenet H. Begley in his 2007 book Spy Wars, and Mark Rebling in his 1994 book Wedge. John M. Newman in his 2022 book Uncovering Popoff's Mole characterizes Angleton as a man lacking self-confidence who required a father figure.
Oh, he needed a daddy.
Oh my God.
Newman claims that Angleton was duped by at least two KGB moles, Kim Philby and MI6, and Bruce Salih in the Office of Security. Newman also suggests that Leonard V. McCoy in the Soviet Russia Division's reports and requirements section may have been a mole as well.
A
set of highly sensitive agency documents referred to as the Family Jewels were publicly released on June 25th, 2007, after more than three decades of secrecy. The release was prompted by an internal CIA investigation of the 1970s Church Committee, which verified the far-ranging power and influence that Angleton wielded during his long tenure as counterintelligence czar. The expose revealed that Angleton planned infiltration of law enforcement and military organizations in other countries and was used to increase the influence of the United States. It also confirmed past rumors that it was Angleton who was in charge of the domestic spying activities of the CIA under Operation Chaos.
Which we knew or didn't know?
Well, we didn't have it confirmed until 2007, because remember, it's all like redacted and stuff. Right, and, like, a lot of this stuff doesn't come out until, like, well after, like, Angleton's dead. Because, like, it's the CIA.
Right.
Because CIA.
Because Angleton dies in 1987.
Okay.
So, man. So it's...
You got to see
so
the Mets, so it's not like, you know, 86.
This motherfucker.
You got to see him. Don't be mad because you like Buckner.
I was just talking about the other night at work, and somebody was talking about like heartbreak, and I was like, bro, I was a Red Sox fan, chill. Like, through his legs! Through his fucking legs, you piece of shit!
Look, he had a big greasy sandwich the night before, and he kind of made the ball go a little faster, if you know what I mean.
It's just imprinted in my fucking brain, my grandfather screaming at fucking Bill Buckner. Just constantly growing up, him screaming about Bill Buckner through his fucking legs.
Whenever you mention Buckner, Ryan's arm just instinctually moves like he's throwing something at the TV.
God damn it. Yeah. Well, I was looking for an ashtray, but I don't know why.
Oh, fuck.
It just felt like the thing I needed at the time.
Angleton's heavily redacted testimony before the State Select Committee to study governmental operations with respect to intelligence activities in 1975 was finally released on March 18, 2025. The 50-year-old top-secret report covers several topics, particularly clandestine intelligence-sharing agreements with Israel, nuclear secrets, Yuri Nosenko, George Blake, signals intelligence, Anatoly Golitsyn, the Warren Commission, and Lee Harvey Oswald. The 113-page, fully unredacted document discloses several matters, including leaks to newsmen Seymour Hersh and Tad Suzuk, and their information about Watergate, Cuba, Project Azorian, and Sidney Gottlieb. In the previously redacted sections, the document is full of MBR markings from the Assassination Records Bureau Review Board, meaning not believed relevant.
Wow, okay.
And I believe that was dropped under that, like, big, I think it was part of the JFK and, like, the other ones where Trump's is like, we're giving it all out. You can all see it.
You can have everything.
Oh, my God.
I want them to release what they got of Tupac. That's what I want.
Tupac lives now.
He's in Cuba.
Hey, yo, what about Ken?
He's hanging out with his auntie in Cuba.
No. He's dead, dude.
But Angleton died, unsurprisingly, of cancer, though, on May 11th, 1987 in Washington.
What kind of cancer did he die of?
I'm not sure. It didn't say.
We're going to look it up.
Is it brain cancer? Because it sounds like he had a traumatic hit that I had at least more than one time.
He died of lung cancer.
That tracks. Well, he's probably smoking constantly with his fucking commie paranoia. The goddamn guy needed a fucking therapist, not a job. Fuck. Jesus. He needed to talk to someone, not have a fucking job. There you go. Then you just made me think of that.
I mean, you're not wrong, though. You needed a daddy, bro.
See that picture I just posted in the chat?
Oh, my God.
So for everyone listening, it's a picture of this guy. He must be working at McDonald's. I don't know if it's fake or not, but it looks a lot like Tupac. And it just says, bro got mad because I said all fries on me. Only 90s people will get that joke. And we have like 16 regular listeners. So, yeah.
No, I'm saying that if Asada Shakur, if you're listening to us in Cuba, if you want to come on the show.
She's open, fucking dead. Get out of here. It's 2025.
They haven't said she died.
You talking about Afeni Shakur?
No, Asada Shakur.
Are they two different people?
His aunt.
Oh, I was talking about his mom.
No, his aunt.
Oh, no. His mom is alive.
Yeah, his aunt. Dead. His aunt is in Cuba. She killed a. She's alleged she to have killed a New Jersey state trooper. Yeah. And she's like, I don't think anyone's heard anything from her or she's like made any like public appearances since like the early 2000s. But she's been living in Cuba since. I know like the one like New Jersey state trooper's family wants her like to come back. But she's still out there, allegedly. I don't know. I think if she did die, I think they'd probably say something.
Yeah, dude, they would be able to keep their mouth shut. They'd be like, yeah, guess who's back, bitch.
Yeah, she's on the FBI's most wanted terrorist list.
Yeah. Because she, like, didn't he, like, even do interviews and say that his mom was, like, a Black Panther or some shit? And that she was legitimately doing things? Like, involved in terroristic activities? Like, his mom was, like, a serious actual gangster.
Well, his dad was, I think. I think Tupac's mom was not really like in that things like Afeni Shakur was. I think she was in their circles, but I don't think she was doing anything. I think his father was like into stuff.
Really?
Yeah, she was arrested as part of the Panther 21. Or maybe I'm thinking of somebody else, because there's somebody else that they talk about that, like, he rides on his dad's, like, cred, but he himself. But I might be thinking of P. Diddy. Because I know they say that about, Sean, like, Tupac.
Combs,
Tupac
Sean Combs' dad was, like, a major drug dealer.
Yeah, he was a drug dealer, but, like, he died, like, when he was, like, two or something like that. And his mother was like completely out of that life. So like any credit he gets from that is just like it's just like tangential to his like father.
Well, mm-hmm. Because his dad was involved with Frank Lucas.
But because like Afeni Shakur was in was involved with the Black Panthers, but like I don't think she did anything, and like she was around for like his life.
That's a great movie, by the way. American Gangster.
Yeah.
All right.
Well, anyways.
Is that it?
That it.
Okay, goodbye.
Good night. Good luck.
Bye.